As a review, and to fit the mood, Zach has made himself a nice dry vermouth martini, shaken, not stirred.
It's shaken, not stirred. I don't like the stirring because it actually doesn't get quite as cold, and I like the dilution with the water in it better because... Because
you're a lightweight?
No, because I use really nasty vodka. I buy really cheap vodka when I buy...
Nice, that'll make you so sick.
I was really excited to see Gone Baby Gone just because... It had a detective theme in it, which is something I always enjoy and stuff. I more recently, things that have come out, like Brick, that had the detective theme in it, is fantastic to me. And Brick is also more interesting because it has the noir thing down, just
the
pat, absolutely
noir
fat.
Language set in a completely
perfect,
contextual,
perfect, yeah.
Strange contextualization.
Yes.
Have you seen that, Austin Brick?
No.
Yeah, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Okay, so Gone Baby Gone... is a film, it's actually the third in a series of books by Dennis Lehane, who wrote the book of Mystic River. And that is not part of the same series, but they're all set in the same time frame in Boston.
Same kind of neighborhood.
And this Gone Baby Gone is the third in a series of the two main characters, which is Casey Affleck and... I always want to say her name is Moynihan, but that's Bridget Moynihan. It's Michelle Monaghan. And they are playing young, kind of streetwise private detectives. And it's not like the same... It's not like what you would think of with a private detective thing, because usually you think of like a Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe thing, where somebody, a sultry dame, comes into this guy's office and, you know, asks for something. It's not like that. In fact, the way they open their own involvement with the case in this movie is interesting because there's a knocking at the door early in the morning, and the guy gets up there and he assumes it's some damn kids or something like that, and he's in his underwear, and it's the aunt and uncle of a missing girl, a missing young girl, and so there's like kind of this embarrassment. They don't look professional. It's kind of like the schlubby detective type thing, except for
their
younger.
At home. I mean,
their office at home.
Yeah. Their wife too.
Well, their boyfriend girlfriend.
Well,
yeah.
It's got a realism to it in that sense. It's like, you know, as a private investigator, you don't necessarily need to have the office with painted, you know, with your name painted on the glass thing, and you know, in the
just
high
like
rise.
Normal everyday people.
Yeah, it's like that's just the job that they kind of have created because at some point they were inquisitive and started solving things and realized they could make a little cash doing that. You know?
Right. So the basic plot is this. Without having to worry anything about the backstory of the characters, because honestly, if somebody just went to see this, they would have no idea that Dennis Lehane wrote a series. This is the third in the series.
Didn't.
Yeah, exactly. I told you this afterwards.
I found that out the day before it came out, as I was listening to NPR,
right.
And they interviewed Casey Affleck and talked about. Actually, not they interviewed Ben,
the director.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he talked about the story and talked about the book.
So the basic plot is this. Patrick Kenzie and Angela Gennaro are this boyfriend-girlfriend, young private detective couple. And they are... it is set up by the fact that a young girl goes missing, and their tearful mother is shown on TV, along with the even more tearful aunt and very distraught-looking uncle.
Who looks like kind of a dirtbag.
He does look kind of like a dirtbag, but he's like a nice dirtbag.
He's a recovering
dirtbag.
Dirt
I don't know, but he looked totally familiar. He actually, you know who he looked like was the similarly dirtbag mustachioed guy from MacGyver.
But wait,
find an older picture of Bruce McGill with the mustache. The guy was a dead ringer for him. Absolutely dead ringer for him. So in this movie, Gone Baby Gone, this girl disappears out of her bedroom. Taken out of her bedroom, middle of the night. No one knows where the kid is. The mother is frantic. The mother... is a dirtbag. She's a female dirtbag.
Yeah.
She is a...
But she makes herself seem like a victim.
Well, she is in this case.
She is a
yeah,
victim.
But, yeah,
but
and you're right, that's not and that's not exactly a dirtbag,
but... But when you first see her on the news, you think this poor woman's lost her daughter.
Yeah.
Until you...
And then you meet her when the detectives meet her, the aunt and uncle come and get the detectives, like I mentioned. They bring him back to talk to the mother. The mother's sitting there with her friend, Bostonian white trash women, watching Jerry Springer, barefoot in tank tops and short shorts, swearing profusely, drinking beers.
And
the mother does not seem that concerned. She's upset, but not so upset that it would take away from her life as a drug-using whore, basically.
Right. So immediately, all your sympathy for the mother, or a good
portion questionable.
And
it gets shifted to the aunt and uncle, because they seem genuinely concerned, and they claim that they both have raised this daughter.
Right.
The story follows the kind of detective thing where it's so curvy and changey in the plot, where things happen and things change again, where it's, to explain this would be to also explain like a Raymond Chandler film or The Big Lebowski. Like, the plot turns are kind of, they happen quite a bit.
Things shift and things change, and it's difficult in the sense of, if you describe your general narrative structure, it's got three acts, you know, beginning, a middle, and end, and all that. This film, I would say, and Zach would probably agree with me, at the end of, Act 1, I think, is pretty quick. It's very quick. And then Act 2, or what you think is Act 2, seems to be pretty quick. And then you almost feel like as if the movie's come to a conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Halfway through, it feels like.
And then it starts a whole other thing.
A whole other story.
Yeah.
Which is honestly kind of how a lot of detective movies and things like, if you watch, like, Kiss the Girls or, like, a lot of movies where, like, serial killers are involved, there will be something where you think that something has ended, and they find someone who was a similar bad guy, but who really didn't have anything to do with it, and they think, well, maybe this was the end of it, and then it turns into something else.
It's particularly unusual in how it...
It had an unusual structure in terms of that act thing, and it is jarring. It's jarring what happens. As Ian brought up, it has a very effective narration in the beginning, where you instantly get put into this neighborhood.
Casey Affleck's character
does the narration.
Oh, I thought it was
Casey. And you're put into this world where this is dirty part of Boston. It's neighborhoods. It's not great. It's not nice, but it's home, and
it's their life.
It is. It's their life, and
it works for them.
It works for them, exactly. And it shows a bunch of different people as he's talking, and there are people who are not dressed very well, and they kind of look malnourished and dirty in some parts of them, and they're not very attractive people. And he's weaving through them as he's talking. And you can see that he has a connection with these people, and he understands them. And this is where he comes in as a private detective. Anyway, so halfway through the film, the narration comes in again. And you're right, it feels like this is a bookend narration.
Yeah.
Instead, what happens is the movie continues for another half. A whole other half of the movie happens after this.
I don't know if it would be the whole half. I mean, really, it feels like it darn well could be, but maybe it's like 40 minutes out of what is a two-hour movie. You know?
Possibly. Very possibly, yeah.
And you're thinking, what does this have to do with the first half? Second half?
And
as
you get to a certain point, you're like, okay, well, this is just more about the characters and how they've been affected by this.
It ends up tying together.
Yeah.
Who else gets involved in this is, as the case continues, Casey Affleck and... Michelle, whatever her name is, are able to. It looks like Monahan
sounds right.
Yeah.
That.
Okay.
They
are able to use their connections with this, like, seedy Boston gangster underworld.
It's the detective thing. It's a private eye thing.
Yeah.
It's been going around since Gilmore. Is that you have an urban decaying environment, and the private eye can go places that the FBI or that the general police can't go because they're familiar with that. They're in that gray area of doing things without rules and operating that way. I mean, they know so many people. They grew up with them. It's like
and the people they have to do this for in this instance are Ed Harris and John Ashton. Is the other cop.
The guy from Beverly Hills.
Yes.
Cop.
Yeah.
Which I thought was awesome. I would give you a high five in the theater.
Right. He really has aged. He's got a lot more waddle fat now. These guys are they're also very Boston. There's a little interesting conversation between Affleck and Harris where they talk about which one is more Bostonian, because he says, well, you're the cop from New Orleans, right? And he says, well, that's questionable because I've been living in Boston longer than you've been alive.
Yes.
And he says, I'm Boston, you're not, basically, is what he's saying. Or you are, but you're no more than I am.
Wherever you are.
They set it up to be that it's the thing where you get a character with protagonists, people ask them for help. There's kind of antagonists lurking in the background. It might have been this pedophile, it might have been this other person. And then the cops, and then you're always introduced to a character that you kind of get the inkling at the while that is not quite what they seem. And that comes into play with these cop characters. And it ends up shifting toward the end where that, by the way, we're trying not to give away too many spoilers with the end of the thing.
It's also a newer movie.
It is a newer movie.
We should try to be better about that with newer movies.
Yeah.
I just wish I could discuss the end.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We can discuss the end in abstract terms, in terms of what the characters do. And that's really what comes fascinating to this, because we've discussed some of the things that seem almost flawed structurally. But it ends up being such an incredible study of character and the devastation of what seemingly becomes a simple right or wrong yes or no question.
Exactly.
And either way, Casey Affleck has to answer this question, this decision that comes up to him toward the end of the movie. It's almost like a no-win situation. And
he knows that either answer he gives is going to...
Right. But he completely sticks by something that he does early in the film, which is he makes a promise to a main character, and his character is defined by his integrity, basically.
His principle.
Right? Yeah, and it ends up being a really strong character, and it's devastating what happens at the end, and it's absolutely fascinating because he makes what seems to be a right choice. A right decision, in a very moralistic sense of the term, and a very, very like law-abiding sense of the term. Not really moral, but more like legalistic.
Right.
And to him, somehow that's right.
It's like he makes the right decision.
Yes.
For the wrong result.
And I thought one thing that was interesting.
Wasn't the right decision.
Exactly. And they kind of make a hint toward that at the very end. I thought what was really fascinating though is that this film is about whether or not someone has the right to take a child out of its home, whatever its background is, which ties into this opening narration. If somebody is growing up and is already part of a neighborhood or an area or a family or whatever it is with terrible flaws, where does someone else's choice to move them out of that or remove them from that or put them in something else, where does that come into play, and how much right should other people have to basically rule other people's lives and decide what's going to make them happiest or whatever. And it has a lot to do with children, mostly, since it's a thing about kids being taken out of their homes, and there's, pedophiles come into play, child kidnappers come into play.
With drug dealers and drug dealers. Yeah.
What's interesting is that in the first book of the series of these by Dennis Lehane, which is never mentioned in the movie, is that Kenzie's character, which is Casey Affleck, his character meets the Monahan character, the character she plays in the first book, and he becomes interested in her. They're working on a case together, and he's interested in her. She's going out with a cop at the time.
How does he let her know that he's really interested in her?
Yeah, exactly. he made her a shell, necklace. She is in an abusive relationship at the time in this first book, which has ties to Casey Affleck's character because he was abused by his father as a child, and I think that would have been pertinent to this, and it made it more interesting to me because I knew this having known about the books. But it's not mentioned, and you think that would have been helpful for people who had not heard about the book series because you know that he actually has something at stake when he's talking about. Like, it makes his viewpoint in terms of the decisions he makes a little bit different.
I feel like that was maybe a potential flaw in the film.
It might have been.
Is not using the source material from these previous two books.
It might have been.
And to add depth to characterization. Because honestly, I thought I was impressed with Casey Affleck in this film.
I agree.
I've liked him in his real, real minor roles in the past. I think that's really all he has done.
That's all he's had.
He's got kind of a funny wit, and it plays in this.
Perfect for this detective
type. People
just
say this terrible stuff to him, and then he'll just be like, he'll blow it off.
Yeah.
He doesn't care. But at certain places in the movie, it seems like his character shifts to such a dramatic degree. It's like, the beginning, he seems kind of like, like Zach said, he's kind of embarrassed, and he's got his diploma for his...
Because he's trying to appear presentable to this family cast, basically.
Where he's got his office in his living room, And so he seems a little like unprepared and like he doesn't know what he's doing. And then he ends up going at some point like the middle, before the movie switches gears a lot, and he's talking to a drug dealer, and the drug, you know, this is a hardcore situation. Drug dealer's pointing a gun at him and everything, and he's as cool as a cucumber.
Yeah.
And
because this is a situation you grew up in, and you don't.
But you don't get that
right.
That characterization.
Right.
So it just feels kind of like, well, how was he? How did he switch?
And
you know,
pass it.
Yeah.
It didn't seem like he would. You didn't know if he would really be
just
a good detective
in, yeah.
until that scene in the bar.
Yeah.
Right.
Early on. Then you
right.
really saw what you were dealing with.
It's, I think the thing is what we're talking about here are those are the interesting flaws that a good movie will have because it's something that makes you think about it more and talk about it more.
Yeah,
and
if it weren't good enough, you'd
get into depth of character. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the bottom line is for me is that this is a fantastic film and it had great acting performances, and the thing I was most, like I said to you, Ian, I was like, I'm not related to Ben Affleck, but I feel proud of him, because this was a fantastic, and it's saying on Wikipedia that it's his debut.
That's
so,
what I was just, yeah, I said that very thing, right after I saw, walked out of the movie.
Because I had thought he had directed one other thing. I thought he'd directed
sure,
some Christmas
but
thing.
But I was just impressed with and amazed by what the talent he could do for this film. I mean, as an actor, he's not that good.
I agree.
I don't see any real depth in any of his characters.
But he obviously has an eye for this stuff,
yes.
and it had a nice look
good
to
source
it.
Material.
Yeah,
it like
yeah, a really good source material. Lahaina, I think, is really good with his characters, and when you see Mystic River, you'll get that.
We
can talk about that another time. I didn't super love Mystic River,
but it was an interesting movie,
I think that has as much to do with Eastwood's vision
yeah.
with it, because he makes everything really harsh, and it's almost like there's no likable characters,
yeah.
and it's too dark
yeah.
in times.
Yeah.
But I still somewhat enjoy that movie because it has a fantastic score, and it feels like a great movie as watching. It's got a fantastic cast. And there's a few moments in it that are really poignant and powerful.
Yeah.
It also feels very sappy to me at times, and it feels like it's a lot of...
I didn't like Laura Linney's
fate. Oh, yeah. I don't like her. I didn't like Marcia Gay Harden. I didn't like the women in it.
No.
Probably one of those movies where you don't really care about the women.
No, it's true, but they have a lot to play in that one.
Yeah.
In this, one thing I think that was another small weakness is that the Monahan character is really important in the books because it's a series about both of them. And this, she's just like a background foil to Affleck.
Mm-hmm.
And there ends up being... the thing is, though, she is like his conscience throughout it. And so I understand how they set up the thing. And there's during the big decision-making thing at the end, she has a huge part to play in that.
Yeah.
And a lot of the recourse happens from her...
She's there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's all kind of leading up to that. And the fact that, like I mentioned, their past with the various abuses they've both been through isn't talked about in this.
I didn't get anything.
Exactly. And the thing is, I knew about this before I watched it, and so I was thinking about this the whole time, and it was endlessly fascinating to me. So I think that helped me. But at the same time, you enjoyed the thing as well.
No, you were
getting into it from a strictly haven't even heard of this thing.
But at the same
point.
Time, I
yeah.
feel really kind of like they just didn't. They could have done more.
Yeah.
Now,
and who knows? It was right under 2 hours, which is about a good time for that type of movie, because otherwise you're going to go too long.
Yeah.
And if you go too short or something like that, you're definitely going to feel like
the,
too much
the
was cut out. So they probably cut stuff out.
Structure-wise, it felt longer than it really was.
It does the thing where it ends five times.
I think in proper sense, it felt to me like there was a
yeah.
three.
No, you're right.
Endings.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes I don't know if that's always good, but then...
In this case, I was actually not as upset with it as I am in most times that it happens in movies. For instance, AI, it pisses me off
yeah.
because it keeps happening. And then after a while, I started looking at my watch thinking, when
yeah.
is this going to end?
Really going to end.
Even when I love the movie,
yeah,
AI
exactly.
is beautiful to look at. And I'm still looking at my watch thinking, this should have ended.
Like
I thought it was only an hour and a half.
I know, but Spielberg do AI?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't even get me on screen.
Another thing I think we should at least discuss real quickly is that the performance by the, and I don't know what her name is, but she's kind of a newcomer for sure. I think she's a local, and that's why maybe she was just, you know, methoding the whole thing.
The mother. Fantastic. Yes, fantastic.
Well, I've seen her in something.
Yeah, you know, she has been in something else. And
but she really...
Because you really...
Amy Ryan is her name.
No. Most of the time, but then you could still feel for her.
Yeah. And she really gives...
Because she doesn't do a switch on it.
Yeah, and she has the deepest performance, because there are a couple of moments where you see the actual cracks in this whole veneer that have been made up of this life of drug abuse and prostitution and everything. Exactly. And it breaks down in a couple of moments. And there's one moment which is really one of the most disturbing in the film, which is the two detectives are driving her somewhere as they're going to go follow a lead. And she's joking around with Casey Affleck in the back seat, and they're talking about the high school they both went to. Yeah. And she's joking around, and she's laughing, and she's punching his arm and talking about how he's... she's like, "Oh, you're a fag. You thought that guy was good looking." And they're joking around and stuff like that. And you're thinking this whole time, I could, like, if my kid was missing, I would be beside myself. And she's joking around with this guy, like, you know. And you start thinking there has to be more to this. She has to know something more. And then it turns out that she doesn't actually know more. And that makes her character even more interesting. Is because she was somehow able to completely shut that part of her mind off. She's just not that good a mother, but she actually does care at a certain level. So, yeah, I think it was a really hard role to pull off, and she did it great. And I think stuff like that always works better with an unknown actor.
Well, I think she was unknown, but I think she's actually, like, I think the part where she grew up, because I saw her on Leno, like, yesterday or something, and she was telling...
It says here she's in New York. Okay. From New York, so...
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. Usually from New York City.
But, I mean, I don't know, you think we've kind of talked about it as much as we can before we... we'll reintroduce it for...
By the way, she's on just from The Wire, so
she's in The Wire.
Yeah, she's second season, third season.
Oh, wait,
starts
to get good, you mean?
Sorry. This is a case where it's hard to do with a movie. This is later in the season, so it's a good time. But Amy Ryan has to be, and they're mentioning it on a couple of different sites.
This is the actress.
Yes, she has to be considered for Best Supporting Actress. Usually, you can see which movies are, like, pedigreed to do this, and with certain known actors, and, oh, Dame Judi Dench was in this.
Great
performance. This is, like, you know, an unknown person who's making a name for herself with this, and I don't know how much people are talking about this, but she really was fantastic in that role.
Yeah, really
and
good. She should
if somebody deserves an Oscar, it's her out of this whole thing. Casey Affleck was also very good.
Ben Affleck for Best Director.
I'm very possibly. I don't know if this was strong enough that you could say that Affleck could, directing-wise.
There was nothing super... the thing about being a good director, it's kind of one of the, like, if you do your job well for certain genres, no one will know anything at all.
And for the most part, I felt that, but there were also moments that I thought were a little heavy-handed. I thought the narration in the middle was really directorially flawed.
Because that's a big flaw, in my opinion. Still.
Directorially and structurally, big flaw.
With the narration in the middle?
Narration at the beginning, narration at the middle when you think that it's ended because the book's end.
Then no narration in the end.
Yeah. That's true.
And so, I mean, just the problem with narration is that it's an easy explication. You're telling, not showing, which is the big no-no in film. You know, it's not literature. You're not reading. I mean, even in literature, it's supposed to be good language that shows you an image, paints a picture. And anytime you do voiceover narration, it's usually because you have such a density of material to get through. And so it works at the beginning. At the end, it plays kind of melodramatic. It almost sort of feels like one of those Bill Curtis A&E things, the first half of the movie, in a lot of ways, because it's got this little narration, you know, it's like, you might as well be saying, you know, this part of Boston was a, you know, had these kinds of people and so on. So, I don't know, I think I would have jumped to the narration and just found a way to work like a 2-minute scene in there. I mean, you kind of got that he knew the area. Maybe just work like a scene that had him interacting with some of the mothers on the stoops or something, trying to, when he was investigating before he went to the bar, and you probably would have been able to convey everything in that first narration. And then in the second narration, you could have done it all with body language as people are watching the news reports about how the girl is not discovered and they're dredging the quarry. That's my little suggestion.
Here's the thing, is that we don't know what they cut out, which is always a problem with something like this. And when something...
Yeah, but if they cut it out, then I'm not going to say, oh, an imagination land.
No, I understand that. But it makes you think, what kind of problems might it have caused for them that they possibly cut out a third narration at the end? Or, for instance, what do you think they felt was the problem that they felt like they had to put that narration back in them in the middle?
I think that they probably just didn't have footage, or there's a variety.
I don't know, because
problems.
I was thinking about this right afterwards. The narration in the middle is happening while he's explaining. The case comes to a dead halt. Basically, is what happens. The girl is presumed to be
dead.
There's nothing they can do about it.
Right.
Nothing can do. It's over. And then what happens is the narration is during a part where it shows a few more scenes of people in their homes in the neighborhood. He's walking through. He comes back, and then it's about what his girlfriend feels about it. Because in the beginning, she says, "Please, let's not do this case because I don't want to find a dead kid." And he says, "I respect that." He ends up kind of pushing her into doing it anyway.
She was being weak. I thought that line kind of conveyed to a strange weakness on her part.
Well, but it ends up being a weakness that sticks with him, like the conscience thing. That's her voice in it, is that whole thing where the whole time he's just thinking of black and white morals. What can I do to help in any situation, this sort of thing? Because it's my job. That's what they're paying me to do. It then shows this thing where he comes in and he listens at the door as he can hear her crying, whatever, and explains that in the narration.
But you don't hear her cry. You see
it doesn't. It shows her leaning, like bent over the desk from the back, and then you see him listening at the door. And then he walks away.
And he said they didn't hear her cry.
Yeah,
they
didn't have to have the narration there.
No,
I don't think they did. It would have worked as a little montage sequence with just some swelling music.
Yeah.
So it kind of seemed like it was just.
News report audio, I think, would have covered it.
Yeah, I think that's something where Ben
Affleck.
And where
the opening one didn't need narration either.
Really? I thought the opening one worked.
I thought that totally worked.
There was some good stuff, and there's some good lines. I think that they liked the lines about, some people say you choose, But I think that could have maybe even worked somehow in the conversation with him and Ed Harris in the middle. They could have worked
that. I think you have to see that stuff in the beginning.
Is what I'm saying. They could have worked that into a scene somehow.
The thing is, though, it sets up the whole theme of the thing with the family aspect of this flawed, broken down community. But that's in terms of the plot. I think it has everything to do with the theme, when you tell that in the beginning.
Yeah, but you don't need to reveal the theme at the beginning of the movie necessarily.
I know, but it makes you understand the theme. It makes you understand the theme when you've gotten that sort of hint about things in the beginning, because it ends up having to do something with the very end of the film.
Yeah, that's true. It does come back around.
Exactly. Yeah. I just think that the fact that middle narration is in there when it didn't have to be, just shows the kind of the rookie nature of the Ben Affleck thing. Which honestly is a fantastic debut. It's not the best, it's probably not the best directed film out there this year, but it was up there.
Yeah, I don't think there's any Oscar for him.
No.
But I think I agree about the supporting actors. That's me about it.
Mm-hmm. It might get a nomination for adaptation too, is from what I've heard.
Awesome.
So,
good screenplay. Yeah. So I would give it a. Okay. We do the letter grade thing.
Letter grade thing. I'm gonna go so far as to give it an A minus.
Pretty good. I was gonna give it regular A because I thought it was pretty darn good.
Okay.
I know they're going to recommend it just about anybody because it's an R-rated movie.
I'm going to go with an A+.
Wow, that good, huh? So that means you think it's better than basketball?
I mean, there's brought up some good points about some of the stuff, but I thought overall...
I think we talked Zach out of an A.
No. There's a lot of things... usually when we do these reviews together... Mm-hmm. It sounds like I like everything more than you, but honestly, it takes a lot to give me an A+ on something. I don't know if there's any movies I would say are an A+ because if I watch something enough, I see problems with them. A+ to me would have to be
Ben Hur.
No, it would have to be like Lawrence of Arabia, but only like an hour and a half long. We'll be right back.
for overusing.
Remember that one episode of Arrested Development where Michael thinks he's trying to teach George Michael about not smoking weed, even though George Michael's actually getting the weed for, I think, his aunt.
He's always something
and,
like that.
And
yeah.
so Job wants to help out, so he's like, well, I can tell him that I can get weed for him, and then we can trap him and trick him and teach him that weed's no good. And so
he uses the hot cops?
Yeah, he uses the hot cops. But the funniest thing is he's like, I'll lie in wait on my boat, and when he comes out there. Like, and so the funniest thing is George Michael comes walking up. He's like, Uncle Job? And he pops up from, like, the boat and goes, hello, George Michael. Like he was, like, ducking beneath the wall of the boat to stand up when he called his name. That's it.